Support for NPR and the following message come from Carvana, on a mission to make car buying more convenient and affordable than ever before. In minutes, you can browse thousands of options under $20,000. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to get started.
This is Fresh Air. I am Terry Gross. Concussion is often much more serious than we used to think, and that's led to changes in places ranging from the football field to the battlefield. My guest Annie Leontis can attest to how life-changing concussions can be. Her new memoir is called Sex with a Brain Injury, on concussion and recovery. Her sex life is just one of the many aspects of life that were adversely affected. During sex, which had been very pleasurable for her and her wife, she felt like a tree stump. The concussion left her with horrible migraines, serious memory problems, foods that suddenly repulsed her, anger issues, and it nearly led to divorce. Leontis also writes about concussion research and the correlation between concussion and crime, prison, and homelessness. She had her first concussion when she was 35 after a bicycle accident when she wasn't wearing a helmet. She had two more head injuries. That may sound improbable, but Leonta says it's actually not uncommon once you've had one concussion to have another. Leontis is also the author of the novel Let Me Explain You, a professor of writing at George Washington University, and identifies as genderqueer. Leontis uses the pronouns they and she, and at this point, I'll switch to they. Welcome to Fresh Air. It is a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Terry.
And also, thank you for doing this while you have COVID. You're speaking to us from your home, and I appreciate you doing it. It sounds like you're in decent shape now.
Yeah, and I'm really grateful we can do this remotely, so thank you for having me.
Me too. So tell us what you experienced at the time you had your first concussion, like when you were taking the fall and your head hit the pavement. What was that experience and the experience in the next few minutes like for you? And what went through your mind?
You know, it was quite startling. I mean, I hadn't expected the accident the way that folks usually don't. I hit my head, and I remember feeling alarmed that I had hit my head. And the world started to sort of pull apart a little bit. Like, it almost felt like taffy, and time started to elongate. I felt just unsteady and unsure, and wasn't sure what to do. You know, I called a friend in the area and they helped me get to the hospital, but I couldn't process very much at all. He was speaking to me and I was not able to understand everything he said. I wasn't sure what I was saying. I ended up at the hospital really disoriented, and really, I think I lost a few minutes in between until I got the CAT scan, which is a procedure I hadn't expected to have to get, honestly. It just seemed like, you know, no blood, no broken bones. Went through the procedure, and they confirmed I had a concussion, which, you know, even then, I mean, I think the medical practitioners were doing what they knew to do, and we understand now that concussions can't be read, actually, on a CAT scan. The axons that connect the white brain matter to one another are finer than a human hair, and so they fray and tear. But our technology is not actually sophisticated enough to catch that. So usually it's the other diagnostics that tell you you have a concussion, you know, whether it's like memory, eyes, balance, fog, dizziness, headache. I had all of that. So they were like, yeah, you definitely have a concussion. They gave me a brochure, and I kind of went home thinking like, I should be good tomorrow. You know, they essentially said, it'll kind of feel like a bad hangover, take some Tylenol and you'll be better, but don't fall asleep alone.
And why not?
Well, I think really the impetus for a CAT scan is trying to identify that there's not a brain bleed, right? Which is like, that's a life or death situation. And it could be that that's still the case within that 24-hour period. And the idea is like, you might fall asleep and not wake up again. So I was okay overnight. And my symptoms got worse as they are expected to do, right? Like your body is reacting and healing, and there's a lot of inflammation. And after that first concussion, I was able to recover in some way. You know, like I did the right things. I got the right care. I got some acupuncture. And I was able to come back from it. But, you know, as per your introduction, after one head injury, even a mild one, you're twice likely to have a second. After a second, you're 2 to 4 times likely to have a third, and so on.
And why is that?
You know, they don't know, actually. That's something, I mean, that's just one part of the condition that we're still trying to figure out. There are a lot of theories about, you know, weakness around the neck muscles, which is why you do a lot of PT for neck strengthening. There's some ideas around reactivity and what you don't see coming because your capacities have been altered. And then there's just the skull itself. And but we don't know. We actually don't know.
So your second concussion, and like, what are the odds? Was it like you were in a shop and a baby car seat fell on your head?
Mm-hmm.
And that's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I felt that way too. I was improperly shelved and these bad luck things happen, but I had turned away from the shelf and it hit me. It was entirely out of my periphery.
How did you handle that? You knew that you were vulnerable already. You already had one concussion, and here it comes again. And those things are heavy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was scary. But I think I was in a little bit of disbelief. Like, no, this can't be another concussion. It wasn't like hitting my head on asphalt. It's just a box. It's just a, you know, I'm in a store. There's bright lights. Like, I have to be safe. This, you know, like, This can't be happening. And sure enough, you know, it was far worse than the first injury, which I really had clear, you know, I had kind of come out of that okay. But that second injury happened and the symptoms were compounding.
Is it typical that a second injury compounds the first?
Well, it does depend how far apart they are. Mm-hmm. But largely the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. And for me, all three injuries happened within a year.
Oh. And you had a third injury too. What was that?
So the third injury was also a bit of a fluke. I was watering a plant and the pot fell. And in hindsight, you know, I mean, honestly, now nothing is allowed above my head anywhere. I'll go to a hotel and take the painting off a wall if I have to.
Seriously?
Yes, I will. I will. I'm sort of pretty, and I think this is very common for people who are suffering from head injuries that you become, you know, at the worst of it, you there's a kind of paranoia that can overtake you, but at the best, you're quite diligent and aware. And I should say that extends beyond me to now my wife has an alertness and my best friend has an alertness and, you know, people who want you to be well and have a new understanding become pretty rigorous themselves. But back then, I just didn't know that, I didn't understand the vulnerability. You know, that second concussion at the store, it wasn't a concussion to me until I was like 3 months in and still dealing with it.
You learned a lot about concussion and about the brain. And you write that the brain is kind of the consistency of butter in a way. Mm. And that when something slams against your head or your head slams against something, the brain kind of sloshes against the skull, the brain pan. I'm not sure which word to use, but did having like a mental picture of your brain and about your brain getting damaged from the impact, was that helpful or was that something that you obsessed on and wished you could stop obsessing on it?
Well, you know, until I was in a better place beyond the acute stage of recovery, which admittedly took around 5 years, I wasn't thinking about my brain like that. I think I would have been too freaked out. What I was thinking about was like the hypervigilance, and that was hard. That was hard to live with day in and day out. You know, this fear that you could get hurt again at any time, and not like another concussion, but if I, you know, Terry, if I shake the orange juice too hard, that could lead to a migraine. You know, if I tap my head on a shelf, and I mean tap, that can lead to a migraine.
Still? Even now?
Even now.
Well, you know, one of the ways of diagnosing concussion is to ask you to draw the hands on a clock. So you're given a, you know, a circle, and you have to draw the hands. And they don't tell you where all the numbers are. You have to figure that out, where to put the six, where to put the three, et cetera. And you couldn't do it. How disturbing was it to you that you weren't able to do that?
Oh, it was so disturbing. I mean, there are certain aspects of your own knowledge that you just take for granted, even when you're unraveling. And that was one of maybe two or three instances in my recovery when I saw myself reflected back to myself. I hadn't known I couldn't draw a clock, but I was in PT for like vestibular therapy, oculomotor therapy, and cognitive therapy too. And the practitioner asked me to draw a clock and just put the numbers, you know, where they should go. And they were all bunched up like I was a first grader. And I didn't even get the six right, which, you know, my little nephew at like age three knew the six. So I'm looking at this and looking up at the woman's face. And, you know, she's sort of like, I think, encouraging me and, but at the same time, I'm completely mystified and completely lost. And I couldn't believe it, honestly, that I couldn't draw a clock. And that was the start to like a pretty long road of recalibration.
How bad had your memory become, and how did that affect your daily life and your ability to communicate with other people?
Yeah. I mean, I think we tend to think of head injury in extremes, right? Like, a severe injury, like a ski accident or a car wrapped around a pole or something, we tend to think of those people as like completely the only model for brain injury, and like almost like complete amnesia. They won't remember people's names, or they'll forget, you know, what they said 3 minutes ago, which can certainly happen to me. But my relationship to cognition, I mean, first of all, there's neuroplasticity, which means that the brain is constantly growing and learning and healing, even when it doesn't seem to be. But also that there are all kinds of slips that can happen even with a mild traumatic brain injury. And so, I mean, initially, I couldn't read. I couldn't look at a screen, and I couldn't read at all. This was another moment where I saw myself reflected back to me. I would read it to the bottom of the page and forgot what I had read like a paragraph ago, which for a writer is terrifying.
You're a writer and writing professor. I mean, that's, yeah, definitely terrifying. Did you start to feel like, is this my fault? It's happened like three times I've had concussions. What am I doing? What am I doing wrong? And did people assume that you were either crazy or that you were just careless?
I mean, I definitely was interrogating. I mean, something happens three times, you know, you get hit in the head three times with a coconut. You're sort of like, why am I sitting under this tree? And for me, I think, you know, I've started to think that there's this unsolvable knot that we all have. And by age 35, 37, whatever you've been running from, evading, indulging, it kind of catches up with you. And for me, it wasn't that I, you know, some of it is just bad luck, right? But for me, a lot of it was that I just thought that I could get through life completely independently of everyone, including my wife. And I could just keep taking care of myself. But of course, you know, humans are not built that way. And if you're injured or sick, you can't. You are in a completely new, vulnerable position. But the problem with head injury, mild head injury particularly, is that it's so invisible. We don't see it. We don't we have no idea people are walking around with this condition. And so a lot of the people closest to me were worried that this was something else, that it was anxiety, that it was depression.
Hypochondria,
right? There was a term that my doctor and people close to me started to throw around, which is somaticization, which is just this, like, it's the new form of hysteria, which of course was leveled against women for a really long time, and still is. And so I was frustrated for a long time that people were not responding to this as its own real issue. But of course, I had to respond first, right? And then I also saw that it was like, you know, it's not your wife, it's not your family, it's the culture. The culture has yet to reckon with what it means to have even a mild head injury, even a concussion.
You'd been with your wife, or the person who is now your wife, for around 13 or 14 years when you had your first concussion. Were there new ways in which you had to depend on her?
There were. I think that was something I had to really adjust to. Even something like I couldn't get up to get a glass of water, or I couldn't make a phone call, because making phone calls was difficult in the beginning. Those kinds of things that you sort of take for granted. And especially because it's not like I couldn't walk. I could walk, right? It's not like I couldn't talk. I could talk. But there were just these triggers that were quite difficult to navigate alone.
How did having to depend on your wife sometimes change your feelings about yourself and your feelings about her and her feelings about you? That's a lot to ask in one question. I apologize.
No, it's okay. I mean, I will say that I really resisted relying in the beginning at all. And I want to be transparent about that, because I think that's a fairly common feeling. It's hard, especially if you are raised in America, to not be independent in certain ways, personally, professionally. And my wife, I think, had always seen me as a strong person and was attracted to that. And I had always seen her as, I mean, she's just like this very loving, caring, doting person. She loves animals. She's, you know, she's a caretaker and deeply empathetic. But it was a hard adjustment for us. Again, I would say in part because the cultural framework wasn't there, right? Like if you're spouse gets cancer, which is a terrible thing, right? Like my niece just came out of cancer, and I can see, you know, like the strain that puts on a family. But we do have a kind of cultural framework around cancer to be able to respond to in a way that we don't quite yet for conditions like traumatic brain injury. And so it was this big paradigmatic shift for us in our own private relationship, where suddenly the roles were shifting, or we had to be present for one another in ways that we hadn't been before. I mean, it was a real test. And the reality is that I think most couples going through something like this, even if they start out with a great relationship, I mean, my wife and I, we're the people that, like, you roll your eyes at because we love each other so much. Like, like our friends celebrate and also envy, I think, sometimes how close we are. But even if you're starting from a really strong place, something like brain injury can really rock the relationship and make you doubt.
Well, you become a different person in a way. If you don't have all your memory and you don't have all your language skills and you need assistance with some things, anger became an issue for you too. What were the kinds of things that made you angry that wouldn't have made you angry before?
Well, just to respond to your comment first, I would say, you know, what I was grappling with was this crisis of the conceptualized self. This is what the philosophers call it. When you're, you know, you literally go from knowing who you are one day to the rug kind of being pulled out from under you. And for me, it was like, as a writer, as an active person, as someone who was strong in body and mind and spirit, to be truly vulnerable and incapacitated, to not be able to write, to not be able to feel confident in front of a classroom, that really taxed me, you know, and it's something that I've been crawling back from and grappling with, and other people I think who have had concussions are dealing with similar things, and becoming suddenly an angry person. I mean, I'm Greek, so like, you know, we know anger, we get it, but suddenly to have a very new relationship to anger and be, it was almost like I was just a pile of dry kindling and anything was a match.
Okay, we need to take another break here, so let me reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Annie Leontis, author of the new memoir, Sex with a Brain Injury, on concussion and recovery. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Hi, this is Molly.
And I'm Seth.
We're two of the producers at Fresh Air. If you like listening to Fresh Air, we think you'll also like reading our newsletter.
You'll find the interviews and reviews from the show all in one place. Plus, staff recommendations you won't hear on the show, behind-the-scenes Q&As, bonus audio. It's also the only place to find out what interviews are coming up. We keep it fun, and it comes straight to your inbox once a week.
Subscribe for yourself at whyy.org/freshair.
Let's get back to my interview with Annie Leontis, author of the new memoir, Sex with a Brain Injury, on concussion and recovery. It's about how life-changing a concussion can be. Annie uses the pronoun they, had their first concussion at age 35 after a bicycle accident when Annie wasn't wearing a helmet. Their second injury was in a store when a baby car seat fell on their head. As a result of the concussion, Annie had debilitating migraines, serious memory problems, an inability to tolerate light and certain foods, and new anger issues. They longed for the person they used to be and found it difficult to accept who they'd become. All this nearly led Annie and their wife to divorce. They made it through to the other side, recovery, but in spite of the word recovery, Leontis is still dealing with certain symptoms of the brain injury. Leontis teaches at George Washington University and identifies as genderqueer. Let's get to the title of your book, Sex with a Brain Injury. You write that you felt like a tree stump during sex, and that had been like, sex had been really pleasurable for you. But, you know, even the best part of sex felt like overwhelming, like more than like your brain could accommodate. That must have felt really awful, too, to have that part of your life compromised.
Well, you know, it's something we don't think about when we think about any chronic condition. We are sort of thinking in these very linear ways about injury and recovery. And I wanted to title the book Sex with a Brain Injury because it points to the reality that such an injury affects every facet of your life, right? Like nothing is unclaimed by this kind of injury. And intimacy, right, between two partners, it feels like it should be this safe harbor, and it's not. And, you know, for me, I would get terrible migraines having sex. And it felt like another great loss, right? It's like not only do you lose TV or music or reading, but even just being in your body in this way that is about connection, suddenly was not available to me for a very long time.
After the concussion and the subsequent concussions, you kept waiting for the old you to return. Was your wife waiting for that too?
I think for a while, yeah. I think a big part of the grief for her was, you know, she was worried that who I'd been was gone forever and who we had been was also gone. And I think that's quite common for couples when a partner has had a head injury, that you find a new normal and a new way to be together. I will say that sounds really dark and glum and like I won't sugarcoat it. It is and it can be. But we also are much more honest in certain ways with one another and can see and support one another, I think, with more fortitude and resilience now. We laugh at more things together because you kind of have to.
How close did you and your wife come to divorce when things were bad with your symptoms?
I mean, we didn't fill out any paperwork, but we were talking about it quite a bit. We had, you know, if you're with someone for 13, 14 years, it's not like you get out unscathed, but these were new challenges. And I think the divorce was a byproduct of saying, like, we are strangers to one another. You know, who are you? Who am I? And that's a really hard place to be in a marriage, even a good marriage or one where, you know, you still love each other, you still like each other, but you don't recognize each other anymore. And the relationship is so frayed, it seems like, how could we possibly keep going? So, you know, we came pretty, I think we were seriously discussing it and thinking like, is this the right thing? Should we keep going? And for a long time, even when we committed and said, like, yeah, okay, let's try, it took another year or so to find our footing.
What kept you together when you were talking about divorce?
I mean, we really love each other, you know, we really do. And we see each other. And I'm grateful that I'm with someone who understands that love demands a kind of elasticity so that people can grow and can change. And of course, in this context, in the context of the brain injury, that had to happen like too fast. And that was the reason for the strain and the difficulty. But also, I mean, we just decided, we said like, we're going to keep trying. And that does make all the difference.
I want to talk about your childhood because it was a difficult one. Let's start with your grandparents who basically arranged a marriage for your mother and your father when she was 16 and he was 24. Why did they do that?
Well, my father, you know, we're immigrants and my father, like any immigrant, saw an opportunity to come to America. And the arranged marriage was really the only chance he had. I can say, you know, my biological mother, both of my parents have since passed, and my biological mother, you know, she had a hard childhood, much harder than my own. She was a queer person who could not be queer in this, you know, 70s and until early 80s. That was really stifled for her. They wanted to get her married because they saw her as a problem, right? Like queerness was a problem. Her substance abuse addiction, which in part was a reaction to the measures of control in her life, the addiction was a problem, and they were looking to find her a husband to take care of that. And my father was, you know, he was young and pretty naive. I mean, Greece today is not the Greece of, you know, 1978 or whatever. It was, he was pretty sheltered. He, you know, the drugs had not really come to the island of Crete yet. He came to America and, like, learned about deodorant. Like, we, you know, he was from a village. And so neither of them was very prepared for the marriage that they were entering into.
How did you find out that your mother was a lesbian, and how old were you when you found out?
Yeah.
Did she tell you, or did you just kind of figure it out yourself?
I mean, I think that had been relayed to me by the adults around me pretty quickly. Again, because we conflate, especially in that time period, queerness, addiction, abandonment of children. It was all seen as the same problem. And so it was almost delivered as a warning to me. But she also was quite open about it and shared that part of herself with me. But because it was such a warning, you know, it was such a dangerous existence, one that put you outside of the law and family and had like real consequences for my sister and I. I just didn't want to be anything like that, you know, and told myself for a long time that I wasn't.
You told yourself that you weren't gay because of her?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You write that years later, as an adult, you assumed the gender of, quote, delicate man. How did you come up with delicate man?
I mean, it sort of springs from, you know, the self. I mean, I think I was deeply influenced by George Michael, both, like, very attracted to and wanting to be George Michael, who is very much, I think, on some level a delicate man. But also, you know, if we're thinking about gender queerness as a spectrum, right? Like, and thinking about having both traits of femininity and masculinity. And I think that probably that was coming through for me even at a young age.
You didn't want to, and still don't want to, ever be pregnant. Did that help you understand your mother and her inability to cope with motherhood? I know some of that had to do, probably a lot of that had to do with her addictions, but nevertheless.
I think so. I think when I realized that I didn't want to ever be pregnant, I'd heard other women say that, but and not disingenuously, but I think the idea of bearing children is like absolutely terrifying for most humans, right? I mean, it's a lot of pain, and I'm deeply admiring of the people who do it. But, you know, for me, it seemed really foreign, really just outside of my physical capacity and something I just viscerally did not want. And that was maybe the first indication, you know, of like, this is a clear genderqueer line. And I think as I got older, I understood that my mother had children because she was kind of put in that position, forced to do that, you know, and she like cursed my father out after my sister was being born. She said, "You did this to me." And I know, you know, I know on some level, she didn't want to bear children, though I think did ultimately want to wish she could be a mother. But for me, with my biological mother, I really put so much distance between us. I scorned her for a long time because of her erratic behavior and irresponsibility. And in researching this book, I came across these studies that suggest that brain injury and drug addiction actually look quite similar in the brain. Like the regions of the brain affected or damaged are synonymous, right? Because we only have so much you know, biological data that can be impaired, right? And then the symptoms, the emotional lability, the irritability, the impulsive behaviors, those end up looking the same. Even the cognitive impairments, there are echoes of one another. And when I reckoned with that, I kind of couldn't believe it. I'd spent all of these years thinking I was nothing like this woman. And not only am I queer, but our brains have been injured similarly. And it helped me have so much more compassion. You know, I didn't just pity her anymore. I understood, I think, on a fundamental level, what she must have been dealing with day in and day out.
Well, let's take another short break here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Annie Leontes, author of the new memoir, Sex with a Brain Injury, on concussion and recovery. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we have very important people on our show and then ask them about very unimportant things. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
We are also reliably informed that among your enthusiasms, in addition to macroeconomic policy, is mobile games.
There is some truth in that.
There's some truth in that.
Join us for the NPR podcast that considers all the other things. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Humans are kind of overrated. Over on Shortwave, a science podcast, we're only kind of kidding. We're bringing you the wondrous world of animal science to your daily life. From queer animal love stories to songbird memories, we're showing you how critter knowledge informs human science. Listen now to Shortwave, a podcast from NPR.
We've talked about how concussion affected everything, you know, your brain, your ability to read, your ability to speak and to write, your memory, your taste, your sense of smell, foods that repulsed you, your ability to be in the light, around certain kinds of light, and how isolating all this was and how it made you, like, question who you are. I want to read an excerpt of the New York Times review of your novel, your first novel, Let Me Explain You. And the excerpt reads, "The experience of Let Me Explain You is less of reading a book than of renting a room in someone's brain, a room boisterous with moving bodies, food smells, noises. It's a festive place to visit." That description is the absolute opposite of your brain after concussion. And I'm wondering if you wrote this before the concussion, or you were still able to write so well and so convincingly of joy and boisterousness that you were able to exit the feelings of your concussion and write.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, the mood is definitely a shift.
So was this before or after the concussion that you wrote the novel?
Oh, I wrote the novel before the concussions.
Okay.
That was part of the reason that I was grieving so much is I had written this novel that, you know, was a pretty big achievement for a writer. You get really excited and you put this work out into the world and it has its own life. But I felt so far away from that book that I turned the spines the other way. I couldn't even look at the title anymore. And I think I might have hurt my editor's feelings when I put that line in the book. But it was so painful to me to have lived in that boisterous, you know, vibrant world and all of a sudden to not have that anymore. And I tried to come back, you know, I was working on a novel. But when I started with the title essay for this book, I realized I would do the experience a disservice if I wrote it as a novel. You know, all we have about concussion are false narratives, whether that's Hollywood or special interests reporting out about the NFL. Like, we just don't actually have an awareness. And I do think we're on the brink of a shift in public perception about head injury, maybe the way we were about smoking in the 80s and 90s, right? Like, we'd had all the data about smoking. I mean, we're getting the Surgeon General's report every year after 1964, after, you know, in the 70s, cigarette ads are banned from TV and radio, but we don't actually have that cultural shift for many more decades. I mean, when I was growing up in the 80s, you could smoke in hospitals and schools and on planes. And, I mean, imagine getting into a smoke-filled, pressurized cabin today. Like, that just wouldn't happen. But it took really till the aughts and the 2010s for not just the legislation or public policy to start to shift, but also our consciousness and awareness. And I think we might be on the brink of that now with head trauma. And so for me, this book felt like it felt like it demanded to be told, both as nonfiction and also really starkly to say, you know, this is what it's like to deal with this for years and not know if you're going to get better.
Annie, thank you so much for talking with us. And it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. And I know that you have suffered like language problems because of your concussion. You seem to be in great shape now.
Yeah.
You have great facility with language now, so that must be a relief.
Thank you. Well, I, you know, just to be transparent, because I would hate to misrepresent the condition. I have a lot of notes in front of me, and and I memorized parts of these answers, and I sort of treated this like studying for the boards. Mostly because I know that it's really important to get the information out there, but I also think it's important to be transparent about the fact that this does take a lot of work, this extroversion and relaying of this kind of knowledge. And I just want people out there who are suffering to know that I can appreciate that that's what they're going through.
Well, this leads me to one more question. Do you keep a journal so that you actually have a record of your experience? Because it sounds like your memory is still a little unreliable.
I keep a lot of notes, but also the book was a way of keeping notes too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Annie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Annie Leontis is the author of the new memoir, Sex with a Brain Injury, on concussion and recovery. The HBO series True Detective returns with a new season next Sunday. It stars Jodie Foster and former champion boxer Kaylee Reese, playing respectively a chief of police and an indigenous detective investigating mysterious deaths in a remote Alaskan town. Our TV critic David Bianculli will have a review after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
On It's Been a Minute, we're keeping you in the know when it comes to culture. I break down the latest trends and the forces behind them and introduce you to the creatives who think deeply about how we live today. Come for some good old cultural analysis and have a few laughs with me. Listen to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Summer is for going to the movie theater because it's too hot to stay home. It's for driving with the windows down, listening to your favorite music. It's for stretching out while you're on vacation to gobble up a TV show. For a guide to some of the TV, movies, and music we are most excited about this summer, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
10 years ago, HBO premiered a miniseries called True Detective, starring Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. It was created by Nick Pizzolatto, who also oversaw two other seasons in the anthology drama, each with a different storyline and cast. The last of them was televised 5 years ago, but next Sunday, True Detective returns with a 6-episode season 4. This time, the creator is Issa Lopez, who directed and wrote or co-wrote every episode. And the stars are Jodie Foster and former champion boxer Kaylee Reese, playing respectively a chief of police and an indigenous detective investigating mysterious deaths in a remote Alaskan town. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
It's been so long since the previous edition of True Detective, and so much longer since its first and most famous installment, that making connections to the original story, written and directed by and starring different people, may be stretching things. Except that Issa Lopez, the director and chief writer of this new chapter of True Detective, intentionally evokes some of the elements that made that first story so gripping. This new edition, called Night Country, also has a horrifying crime scene, a clash between two investigators with very different personalities and approaches, and a sprinkling of supernatural elements that may or may not be real. The setting, this time, is a remote town in Alaska, where the entire crew of scientists at an Arctic research station has gone missing. At first, it seems like a matter for the local cops, who enter the abandoned research station to investigate. There's Pete Pryor, a young officer played by Finn Bennett. His father, Hank, a veteran local cop on the same force, played by John Hawks. And Liz Danvers, the chief of police, played by Jodie Foster. They find phones left behind and sandwiches uneaten, but only Danvers connects the dots correctly in establishing a timeline.
Sat phones are back there. These are the cells I could find. This one was charging, and that one was just there, just like that. Dead battery.
Who leaves their cell behind?
Well, it's not like there's a lot of cell signal out there.
It's not like there's a lot of anything out there. All right, well, let's get the cell records and the radio log, Pete.
Yeah, that ham seems pretty fresh.
All right. We're going to call in rescue. Let's get the choppers. Ping this site as an LKP and then 15 miles POA.
Whoa. Word will spread. Your families will be upset. And if these dorks turn out to be just out on some geek expedition, don't you want to hold off for a bit?
No, Hank, I don't. We're late to the party already. Ham and the sandwich may seem fresh, but mayo's like syrup. Mayo doesn't go runny until a couple days out of the fridge. But your processed cold cuts must survive the apocalypse. The things you learn when your kid leaves at lunch in the backseat of the car. You were never much of a sandwich-making kind of dad, was he, Pete?
Clearly, this group of cops has its conflicts. But conflicts run all through this small town. There are the native Alaskans versus the polluting mine operators, but there also are mothers against daughters, sisters against sisters, husbands against wives, and so on. Maybe even the living versus the dead. And the primary conflict is with Foster's Chief Danvers and just about everyone. Most prominently, she has a fiery past with a detective, Evangeline Navarro, who's interested in this new case, but who still has issues about a murder the two women, when they were partnered together, were unable to solve. Kaylee Reese, an indigenous champion boxer-turned-actress, plays Navarro, whom Foster's Danvers snaps at almost instantly.
Oh, no, you're not going to blame her on me. And I wasn't even here. You know who was here? You. You were here. It was your case all those months. You didn't close it. You.
Exactly.
It's this new case, though, that brings Danvers and Navarro back together, working in a state of almost constant friction as the clues and mysteries and bodies start piling up. The two leads work very well together and are very impressive. For champion boxer Kaylee Reese, this has her entering a whole new ring, and she's triumphant here, too. Foster, who has several emotionally raw scenes as Liz Danvers, carries the weight of this True Detective series impeccably and confidently. As an actress, she's covered this kind of territory before, just as brilliantly, in The Silence of the Lambs. And she's no stranger to television, either. Her first TV acting job was at age 6, on an episode of Mayberry RFD. True Detective Night Country is the best entry in this anthology series since the original. And this time, as with the first time, it's the direction and the mood, as well as the acting and writing. As director, Issa Lopez gets every drop of tension and horror out of her scripts. A few times, I actually gasped at what was happening. And the Alaskan location scenes, filmed in Iceland, make for some of the most remote and desolate winter panoramas since Stanley Kubrick filmed The Shining. Also adding significantly to the mood is the music, including the theme that opens each episode, a superbly appropriate use of the Billie Eilish recording Bury a Friend. It's creepy, distinctive, and haunting, just like this new 10th anniversary edition of True Detective.
What do you want from me? Why don't you run from me? What are you wondering? What do you know? Why aren't you scared of me? Why do you care for me? When we all fall asleep, where do we go?
Come here.
Say it, spit it out.
David Bianculli is a professor of television studies at Rowan University. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, our guest will be actor Paul Giamatti. He just won a Golden Globe for his performance in The Holdovers. He plays a pompous and disliked teacher at a boys' boarding school in the 70s. He's assigned to take care of a teenage boy who has nowhere to go over the winter holiday. The Holdovers is the second collaboration between Giamatti and director Alexander Payne. The first was the surprise hit Sideways. I hope you'll join us. Our co-host is Tanya Mosley. I'm Terry Gross.
Why is everyone so obsessed with traditional wives or trad wives on social media? This week, we're talking about the viral videos of women making marshmallows and mozzarella from scratch, and how behind the sheen of calm kitchens and cute fits, there's some interesting pessimism about our modern world. And that's worth digging into. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.